Okay, so today we have David Subar. Thank you for joining. I think I'd like to just start off with talking about your career path. So let's jump right into it.
Sure. So I started my career doing research and development in AI and machine learning at a military-owned think tank in DC. And we were doing a lot of different projects for various aspects of the military, and some of the other three-letter agencies. And they were relatively interesting about some bad guys coming over the hill. How do you determine who they are and what they're trying to do, particularly when they're trying to not deliver information to you that's relevant and trying to spoof information? And some of that stuff I can talk about, and some, frankly, I still can't. But I'm going to give you the big takeaway on what I learned. And this is a big pivot point for my career. I graduated knowing I wanted to work in AI and thinking I wanted to work in R&D. And that's what we were doing. We were advancing the state of science. And I found out, I was there for, call it 3 years, and I found out that I did not want to do research and development. It was I and as a background is, you have to understand, and this may be similar to many other people that you talk to, many people listen to, like, I grew up as a nerd, right? And I grew up, on an Apple II, writing code when I was 12, right? None of this is probably unique to me. None of that's unique to me. And I really thought I wanted to do research and development. And what I found out was, when you're doing research, real research, a good output is a paper and some learnings on that paper. And if it's a good paper, you present it at a conference. And if it's a good conference, 200 or 300 people listen to you. And then generally nothing happens. And I found that really unfulfilling. Now, I'm not trying to denigrate research. Advancing the state of science is super important. I'm just not built that way. And so what I wanted to do was, how does technology change markets? How does technology change people's lives in a direct way? What could I show to my mom and say, I did this? And doing research obviously in a classified environment, you don't get to do that. And so that was a major pivot point for me. And it was very early in my career. And I decided, I want to write code. I want to build products that change things in a demonstrable way. And so for I went from there, and I did exactly the opposite. And I went to Booz Allen and Hamilton, which was a consulting firm, and we were doing applied applications of AI to corporate clients, and this there for a few years. And then I went to product companies, and first an AI tools company and a variety of other companies. And I started out as an engineer. Then I started managing teams, larger and larger teams, eventually became CTO of companies, and then CTO and running product as well. And why both? So my fundamental thesis was, I wanted to use technology to build experiences, to change people's lives in some way. And by running product and engineering both, I had both the what and the how, the envisioning of what to do and the actual building it. And that was the point of the arrowhead for me. That's where I wanted to get. I ran a game company along those times. I was CTO and also running product of a company called Interthinks that was doing intelligent systems for finding fraud in the mortgage space. I was at online media companies, but like this focus, that pivot point of going from research to shipping product was the fundamental thing. And that's, frankly, that's how I've organized my career. That was the fundamental point of, how do I think about everything that I work on? But also, how do I think about who I hire, how we retain people, how do we get organized with each other, How do we know if we are really producing value?
Yeah, definitely. And that's a big part of what I want to talk about, is both attracting talent and retaining them through these kinds of programs for growth and managing the career path. Would you say that transition from your earlier career where you were just doing engineering over to those engineering management and then eventually CTO roles, kind of talk about how that transition happened. Did it come naturally? Was it a lot of hard skills to learn? What was that like?
The answer to both those questions are yes. which is, I recognize that this is something that I wanted to do. And you know, people have this decision to make of, am I just going to be an engineer and that's what I'm going to do with my life and I'm going to be happy with that? Or do I want to go into management, and where do those diverge and how do you think about them? And because I wanted to, like I mentioned before, I'm born a nerd, right? It's congenital. I love technology, but I did not want to have my fingers on keyboard all of the time. I wanted to learn and understand that. And I think if you're going to be a great manager of technologists, you do need to grok that stuff. You need to deeply understand it. But I started getting focused on how do I create teams of people that can create great products, as opposed to what is my solo contribution? But you know, to your question is, were there hard lessons to learn? Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that I just did not know that until I started executing, I didn't learn. Like, how do you communicate timelines? Mm-hmm. That is a non-trivial thing. How do you understand timelines, and then how do you communicate them? How do you communicate what results are important? I think a lot of people make the mistake of saying, I'm going to talk about our increased velocity to the CEO. That is almost always a terrible conversation. Mm-hmm. But those are the conversations that people start out with. Those are the conversations that I started out with. And they're frustrating for everybody. But yes, there's a bunch of hard lessons to learn like that about how do you get alignment with the rest of the company? How do they see you producing value? One of the big mistakes for a CTO is if they are in part of an organization that looks like a cost center, as opposed to a profit center. And so what I mean by that is, and this is why I chose to be a CTO and not a CIO, is if you are in a cost center, at the end of every year and they redo budgets, people say to you, that was awesome, great year, thank you. We want you to do more next year with less.
Right.
That's never fun. I want to have the conversation where they say, great year last year, that was awesome. What can we do to increase investment in your group so you can do more better things?
Right.
And learning how to have those conversations, not just with executive manager, but with the team that's actually doing the real work, like, that's non-trivial to figure out. And there was some hard lessons I learned and some things I was told and some things, you know, I figured out quickly, and there was a bunch there to do. But it's not just getting aligned with executive management. It's how do you create an environment for the engineers in the organization, for the product managers in the organization, and for everybody else in the engineering or product management organization, that they're also on the same page, that they're also traveling the same path?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to kind of touch on that a little bit, because I've seen and been in organizations where product and engineering do not necessarily roll up to a CTO.
Yep.
In fact, that's one of the first questions I ask other CTOs I meet at, you know, networking events and stuff, is, you know, what's your org look like? What's the structure? Because sometimes you see this structure where, you know, engineering goes up to one side of the house and product goes to the other, and there's sort of this wormhole or black hole between the two leaders. And often they don't talk, or maybe they're traveling. You know, sometimes I've seen basically a CEO take over product and a CTO take over engineering, and it's really two sides of the same coin. And when there's these disparate things at the top, there's often a lot of those disconnects, like you said, with understanding velocity or understanding changes, the thrash, et cetera. So I think that's very interesting that you've taken the reins on both of those things. And do you have any anecdotes or history where maybe that wasn't the case?
Yep, sure. So sometimes it makes sense them to both reporting to the same person, and sometimes it doesn't. And I have some metrics I think about in order to, how do you make that determination? Now, these aren't hard and fast rules, but things that I've found generally apply. In B2C companies, it's a lot easier for product and engineering to report to the same person because all of the signals are coming from usage of the product.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what should we do next? How do we think about it? What do we adjust? It becomes much easier in that case. In B2B products, sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. But and because signals might come in from sales, from marketing, from other places, and in some case, the outward-facing role of the product role is just bigger and so more diverse. But in either case, the relationship to whoever is running product and whoever is running engineering is critical. If those two people don't get along, it's poison.
Yeah, definitely. In some past experiences I've had, we'll literally sit at the same aisle or the same desk, or we'll be literally joined at the hip in that regard. Not just because, you know, the small talk that benefits during the day, but it's even a show of solidarity to the rest of the org too. Like, these two people are together all day, you know, in a metaphorical sense.
Right.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm super passionate about this. So let me tell you, I've run product and engineering for a long time now, but for the last 6 years, and so this will explain my passion. So I kept getting more meta in my career. So first I was doing research, and then I was doing practical applications, and I was running teams of engineers, and I was running teams of engineers and product managers. And now the last 6 years I've been spending consulting to technology companies about product management and engineering. And how do you make product managers and engineers more effective in building and shipping product, getting feedback and doing it again and again? So this particular set of questions is near and dear to me because this is what I do. I've worked from small startups to the Walt Disney Company. And so this is literally what I think about all the time.
Excellent. That's great. Actually, there's one thing I wanted to jump back to real quick on the R&D side of things. When you first mentioned it, I thought of R&D in sort of a corporate sense, which has some similarities. For example, it could be documents, it could be, you know, research that you present, but it also can be POCs, you know, early stage products, things like that. But I think what they both have in common is that you're inherently, well, you might be throwing something away when you're done. In fact, you often are. Because sometimes things don't pan out, et cetera.
Yep.
I found, I'm just going to make a statement, but then turn it into a question. In my own path, I found in earlier stage startups I've been in, I'm the one that takes those arrows because of a couple of reasons. I'm a hacker too, and an engineer first kind of mentality, I think, like yourself. And also, I found that engineers hate to see their work not come to fruition. Even if they know it's just, you know, a POC or R&D. And oftentimes, I'd say like 80% of the R&D I've ever done never even saw the light of day. Some of it gets refactored quickly into production level stuff. But do you still have that hacker or that bug to code things every once in a while? Do you still get on the keyboard and pound that out?
So I do, and I do it for, the reason I do it for is in order to understand new technologies, it's important to have exercised them.
Yeah.
And so, and I don't get to do this nearly as much as I would like to, but I like to go and try to hack something out so I can grok it as opposed to just read about it. I think it's important.
Yeah.
I think it's important. With regard to your POC thing on research, I think about that differently, slightly differently than you suggested. And And it's a goal, a difference in goal discussion. So I argue that all code is short term.
Definitely.
And right. There should be an expectation that it's all going to get thrown away. And the measurement of goodness is, did we create something of value to someone? Or are we further on that path of learning to create something of value for somebody? I actually encourage people to, and I'm going to say this carefully, to write code quickly and to build and to expect to be refactoring all the time. I don't expect engineers to be efficient. I expect them to be effective.
Yep, absolutely. Right? Yeah, right? I found that in coaching engineers, you know, you're not writing your magnum opus here. You should be prepared to actually pretty much any reasonably designed product that's not too complex can be rewritten in a quarter pretty much. And people challenge me on that. And then the value of the product is not that pile of code you've got sitting there. It's about all the learnings, like you said. How does it work? What's the usability? How did you scale it, et cetera? And it's usually younger engineers that you know, want to try and overthink it and overanalyze and you know, the analysis paralysis that comes with wanting to make something that will last a lifetime. Nothing ever does. I think it's just through experience you see code bit rotting or, you know, needing, you know, the perfect example with many companies was going from Angular to React, you know, things like that. So you should be able to write stuff so much quicker. And if you can't, then you need to look inwards in your process and your team, et cetera.
Writing perfect code makes an assumption, which is untrue, is that product managers are good at their job. That is a job that's impossible to be good at. And what I mean by that specifically is, great fidelity on what the market wants, it's impossible to say. So the process of envisioning something, creating code, getting out into the marketplace and coming back and doing it again and again is a walk through the requirement space. And if you're making that walk really expensive by making perfect code, you're learning slower.
Exactly. Your learning rate's affected. And furthermore, you know, that's seen by folks as thrash when it's not. You know, a part of this article is going to go into a little foray or a little tangent I took reading like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Glassdoor reviews, and inevitably the view of the senior management, which often includes product and engineering leadership, is always lower than everything else. And it's because I think there's an unreasonable expectation that everybody just knows what the market's going to want. And it's a bit of an inflexible type of thinking.
Right. And if you've never done those jobs before, it's a reasonable type of thinking, but it's inflexible, as you pointed out. And what I say to engineers are, well, given, you know, there's an assumption that executive management knows exactly what the market wants, would it be reasonable to assume that you know exactly how long things are going to take? And the answer is like, no, of course not. We're doing this for the first time. And that's exactly the same through with the gym. And it's getting that empathy through the organization, not just the engineers for executive management, but executive management down to the engineers. Like, that's the key to making these groups work together well.
Yeah. So if you could, maybe, you know, you mentioned earlier just about the different kinds of companies that you're inside of and so forth. So starting from around the time you were, you know, in engineering leadership, maybe talk about the different companies in just broad strokes.
Yeah, sure. So been involved in different companies, different sizes, everything from small startups, mid-sized company, large companies. I'll give you a couple examples. I ran my own game developer. We did games for Electronic Arts and Activision and companies like that. That was a company we had like 12 engineers and we hired outside for artists and game designers. In the initial internet boom, I was CTO of companies of sizes, you know, 20 to call it 100. I ran engineering for a while on an interim basis at lynda.com before they got sold to LinkedIn for 1.5 $1 billion. It's crazy. I was consulting to the president of Disney ABC Television Group, first the CTO and then the EVP, then the president of Disney ABC Television Group. I did work at a company called Meta, where I was on an interim basis running hardware, software, product management, neuroscience. They were doing an augmented reality headset, physical device. But we were building an operating system and an API and an SDK. And that company was 75 people-ish, maybe it was 90 people. Most of it was some kind of engineering. So companies of all different sizes, different stages. But the main focus has been the stuff that I mentioned before about how do you build teams that can build great products?
Yeah, definitely. So there's got to be some differences in, say, a 20-person team versus maybe that 100-person team. So, you know, can you maybe describe some of the differences in your strategies to have that trickle down through your org?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and there are. And 20-person team, 100-person team at Disney, the team was much larger. There are differences. Part of it is based on how hands-on can you get with the people in the engineering or in the organization, engineering or product management. How do they get to know you? How do you get to know them? How do you deliver information? It's much easier in a smaller team.
Right.
But there are inflection points, like 5 to 15 is you do it one way, right? Under 5, you do it one way. 5 to 15, you do it another way. At, you know, 20 to 25, that's another inflection point. There's another one at about 50. Maybe there's another one at 75, another one at 120. And the when the teams are smaller, it's much easier to communicate directly. And, it's much easier for everyone to know each other. When the teams get to be 100 or bigger than that, you're counting on your managers for delivering the message, for getting feedback, and how you do that. And this is where empowerment gets really important. And what are you talking about becomes really important. When you're a team of 100, certainly, maybe and before then, you can't get into low levels of the architecture. But you get to, here's what we're trying to solve for, and tell me how you're going to solve for that. And let's beat on each other's ideas a bit so we get to fidelity to where we want to go. And how you recruit and how you retain and what you measure and what you talk about is critical as the teams get bigger and bigger, because it's very easy to see the person who is, you know, much higher on the org chart or much lower on the org chart as not a person.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of a good segue there. So, you know, just to tie into the next piece here, you know, I like to think of the engineering talent market as very much a seller's market, right? It's really hard to find good talent and similarly to be able to retain good talent. So, you know, some of the examples I use for this is, here's a quick little side story. I used to interview every month for about 10 years. Like it was in the early 2000s and I was a senior developer engineer at the time and I just had my first kid and so forth. And I was really freaked out about losing my job. So I went to a lot of different companies all over the place. And inevitably, I started to see I was interviewing them even more than they're interviewing me. And you know, I start to look at like how do they function? What do the people look like there? What kind of questions are they asking me? And really, you know, what's in it for me to be at an org like this? And it became almost a guilty pleasure. I think I interviewed probably over 100 times in this program just for a decade, like I said. And then furthermore, being on the other side of the table for another 10 or so years, interviewing and hiring lots of people, and I could almost tell who were the outstanding performers because they're doing the same thing, right? They want to peel back the layers and go deeper into examples, you know. And good people would say, like, can you give some examples of people who have grown here? You keep talking about growth, like let's see that, you know, give me some examples. And conversely, I've had people, you know, you ask people, why are you in the market? And they'll tell you that they come to work every day. It's like Groundhog Day. It's the same thing. You know, their management doesn't really understand well what they do, et cetera. And so what we'll talk about next is, you know, how do programs specifically for individual growth, you know, how, what are your strategies and tactics for implementing these things? And, you know, similarly, it's kind of two sides of the same coin when it comes to managing someone's career path, because that's something that usually spans before they started working with you. And it's something that is definitely going to go beyond when they're working with you. So you can tie those two things together. And that's really a big part of what I'd like to talk about next. A lot of my questions often wonder about the differences of how people go from being in a small situation. You know, you might start out as a engineering manager, you have one team, maybe there's 7 people or 10 people. And to manage an org at that size is much different than one with, you know, many engineering managers, directors of engineering, and a whole management structure. So I'm wondering if you could take the conversation towards how did you really scale this and get the ethos to permeate through an organization?
Let's take two versions of being small. Small is I run a team of 7 people, 10 people in a larger organization. That's interesting, but I'll talk about it in a second. Versus I'm in a startup and there's only 7 in the total engineering population of the whole company. So the way you manage, you know, small numbers of engineers is very hands-on. It's very different than when you get bigger, but it's easy for everyone to sit in a room, or if you have a remote team, to be on Zoom with each other all day and have this high touch interaction. And that's great for small teams, and it's very kind of low latency, low bureaucratic way of doing things and optimized. Then your team gets bigger and you get to maybe 15. Now you've got a couple teams and there's some level of abstraction in the communications, but you can still get hands-on with people quite a bit, but you're not necessarily in code every day doing it yourself because there's too many things to do. And that's, you can kind of ad hoc that still, right? And maybe you'll use some agile technique like Scrum or XP or Kanban to start doing things in a more formal way there. But a lot of that still tends to be ad hoc. Where it really starts to change is when you hit a threshold of 25 or 75 or 125. Each of these places, things start to change what you do, how you manage, what you're looking at. And the key is certainly when you get into bigger and bigger numbers, is how do you fractalize it? And what I mean by that is, how do you get the teams aligned and producing value as atomic units without having to require much day-to-day interaction? And how do you do that where people not only feel part of their team, but part of their company, know that whoever CTO or chief product officer still care? And how do you make sure that you have alignment on mission among those? And there's different techniques, and the communication patterns are different as you grow. But my fundamental thing that I do, the fundamental thing I think about is, how does goal setting happen? How do results happen? So I believe that there's a social contract between a manager and someone who reports to that manager, whether that person is a independent contributor, individual contributor, or whether it's a lower level manager in the organization. And the contract goes like this: is it's the manager's job to set some kind of goal state. Here's what we want to get to, and here's why. The person or people that are fulfilling that goal state get to ask a lot of hard questions. They get to why is that important? Why are we thinking about this? Shouldn't we consider this? At some point, you get to a decision, hopefully quickly, like, here's the final goal state. We're agreed. It was set generally by the manager and punched up against by the people that are going to get done, but we've agreed on what it is, and that's what we're going to get done. Now, It's the people that are actually executing it. Their job is to say how. They go away and say, come back and say, here's how we're going to get it done. Now it's the manager's job to ask them hard questions. And asking instead of telling, because in asking you learn things you might not expect. They might know something you don't know, right? If a manager tells someone who works for them what to do, they will tend to do it whether it's right or wrong, just because the power of the office. But if you ask, then you find out, like, here's the way that person thought of it. They might be wrong, they might be right, but in asking, you find out. And in my experience as a manager, by asking people questions, when they get used to it, they come to meetings being more thoughtful about what they do. So first stage, set the goal set. The people that are going to execute ask the questions. Second stage, the implementation gets discussed, and the manager asks the questions. Now you've hardened on goal, you've hardened on implementation. Now it's time to run. So, okay, we've agreed, go do it, go get this done. And the manager's job is to check in, make sure it's getting done approximately. Now, hopefully you have a team that's executing that will bring problems up before the manager recognizes, like, here's something that happened. It's different than what I thought. We have to change plans that way. That's optimal. Manager checking in enforces that. So one role of the manager is to check in. The second role, and maybe the more important role, is to get impediments out of the team's way. What is it that you need in the environment that I can do for you so you can run, so you can get this stuff done? Now, I describe that generically, right? When I talk about the fractalization of how to run organizations as they get bigger and bigger, this methodology tends to work well at different levels of abstraction. A team of seven that exists in a team of, you know, several hundred engineers and product managers. A team of 25 that might have several teams of seven in it. Seven's an arbitrary number. A team of 100, right? This methodology tends to work well. And there's different companies implement this different ways. Amazon famously has the 6-page memo.
Right.
Everything's written up at 6 pages, but there's, you know, the final 6-page memo for Bezos is composed of a bunch of 6-page memos for his direct reports, which are composed from a bunch of 6-page memos under it, right? That's one way of implementing this conceptualization. But what you want is you want teams that understand what they're supposed to get done, execute well, and have all the tools they need. And as you get bigger and bigger scale, you can't have your hands in code. You may not even have your hands in the lower level parts of the architecture. What you want to do is have an assured process of everyone's running along the same mission and executing well.
Yeah. So I love that analogy. I love the self-similar analogy that you get with fractals, that regardless of the level you zoom in or out of. And that's a great way to look at scaling process in general across the org. And when I'm looking at growth, granted, inside of all of that, there are challenging situations. People are making commitments in scenarios where they themselves need to be stretched in some way professionally. Maybe they've never led such an initiative or done such a thing. And that kind of growth is kind of the gimme part of it, in my opinion, because it's kind of an expectation of the role they're in. It's an expectation of every individual contributor, et cetera, to be growing along the way in that regard. But I'm also looking at that next level where every IC has a manager or somebody who's also managing their own personal growth path, which in any successful company, the alignment needs to be there. You're not just learning Swahili or something like that, unless the company needs you to, but, you know, learning Rust or Golang or some other thing, because the company might go there, there's that, right, et cetera. But I think there's a possible way to superimpose that self-similar nature to the process you just described, but with respect to the individual, and specifically that Socratic method, the expectation setting, sort of saying, look, this is the next hill you're going to climb. Let me invert that. The individual says, I think I want to climb this hill, and getting that validation and so forth. So in this next sort of direction, beyond just the expectations of what's needed for a team, that baseline growth, how about the outsized growth, that the extra step of growth that a lot of engineers and people need just to feel well engaged and that they're going somewhere in the long
individually.
Term. Individual growth.
Yep. You know, individual career management's an interesting thing for individuals. Like, how do you get to the next step? Whether that next step is, I want to go from developer to senior developer to lead to architect, or I want to go from developer to some kind of management layer to, you know, managing larger and larger teams to becoming a CTO, right? Though, where a CTO in that case is just maybe a VP engineering is a better way to describe it, but where it's described as the manager of people and process. That kind of growth is interesting because there's somewhat of a joint responsibility. The joint responsibility is the person who wants to grow and the manager that person might report to.
Right.
The ultimate responsibility for the person's growth is that person, right?
Ultimately, yes, agreed.
Right, ultimately, right. But as a manager, particularly if it's someone I want, and if it's someone I don't want in my organization, I need to solve it a different way. But assuming I only have people in my organization that I want to provide them with opportunities so that they can learn those things and they have it. Now, if you're in a growing company, it's a lot easier to provide opportunities than if you're in a shrinking one. And if you're an individual contributor, I suggest that you want to be in a growing company rather than a shrinking one for a bunch of other reasons. But it's important as a manager to know the people in your group and know where they want to get to and provide them opportunities as they occur in the organization. Now, I'm parsing that very carefully. So what I'm not saying is create opportunities that don't naturally exist, right? Because it has to be the person and their career trajectory and the needs of the company have to be aligned, right?
Absolutely.
Right. And so it's important to know the people in your organization, know what they want. It's important, by the way, this is like extra credit, but extra credit that I definitely suggest is ask them hard questions about why they want that and does it really get to them where they think they're going to go, where they think they want to go.
Yep.
Right. So I was with a junior engineer over a coffee over the weekend, and he asked me for some time to give him some advice. So we went out for coffee and he had a particular career goal and I asked him why. And his answer was, I thought that it wasn't this cute, but it was, well, I thought that might be a good thing to do, but I'm not really sure. And so I said, asked him why, and he didn't really actually have any reasoning to back it up. So we got to some fundamental questions, which were, where do you want your life to go?
Right.
Like, what do you love? And then from there, we were able to come with some more fundamental, like, here's a path that you should try. That, you know, you take this next step. And I'm trying not to give away who this candidate is, so I'm being kind of general here. But for someone who might know him, here's the next step that you might try that will open up these four doors. And don't be so convinced that this door seven steps ahead is the one you want. Go through this next step, look at these four doors, and then take the next step and the next step. So feel free as a manager to question the person who's worked for you what their next step is and why. Yeah. And then, to the extent you can, provide them for those opportunities to the extent that you have the tools to provide.
Absolutely. I think you're threading the needle there perfectly in the sort of relationship between growth and your career path. And you're talking about making sure that the immediate growth you're focused on, the things that you're working on, are they internally consistent with where you want to wind up, number one? And, number two, does that also align with the company, right? Like, does that, you know, and in most growing companies, like you said, those opportunities emerge. It's like emergent space time. It gets bigger and bigger. And all kinds of needs pop up through different company cycles. One other just quick tangent story that's fun is, you know, my boys have been taking martial arts for 15 years now, since they were 3 years old. And you know, you ask a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, what do you want to be when you grow up? And every single one of them will say, Taekwondo master, sir, right? Because that's what they think the other person wants to hear. And they themselves are in a very early part of life, right? And they're trying to connect the hard work they're doing right now, which is basically dodgeball and jumping over pool noodles and things like that, to some kind of thing that they think would they would be respected for. And you'll see that too in this notion that engineer, developer type folks, their only real path is to go to management someday. And that's been sort of disproven as tech companies have gotten bigger and there's no more of an industry now than there were, you know, 30 years ago or whatever. But that's a great way to put it. I like how you tied those two things together, because a lot of this type of work, I jokingly say you're being an armchair psychologist and a camp counselor with people, and just the ask why 10 times thing, you know, the Socratic method, et cetera, so effective. And I love hearing that. Great analogy. Yeah. So
well, the other thing is, like, the world's a very big place. And when you're just starting out, you don't know how big it is, and you don't know what all of the opportunities are. And being asked the question, being introduced to different kinds of things, like, I didn't even know that was a choice. Right. And when someone doesn't know that something is a choice, they don't think of a path to get there because they don't know there's a there.
Yep. Absolutely. And that kind of goes to some of these orgs and folks I've talked to who put an emphasis on a published career ladder, you know, like, and actually locating from the time from your first day at work, or even beforehand, before you're hired, you would be here, you know, engineer level 3 or whatever it is. Yeah. And this is the kinds of expectations, this is the level of autonomy, et cetera, that is expected of you at this level. And, you know, based on your career experience and your CV and what you've told us, we think you're there. Provided, you know, you stick with us, you're going to go to level whatever and da, da, da. And well, you know, if you want to jump over to the management ladder, you can do so. And a lot of good conversations in this series about how folks have done that and stuff. And, you know, it's interesting. That one of the interesting quotes was that it's not a promotion. And I kind of like that, actually. It's a lateral at best. And even somebody else said, I wanted to demote people just to make sure they were in enough to really want to do it. But, you know, they can't take a pay cut, obviously, but it is a different kind of set of skills. And people who are really good at engineers have to learn a whole bunch of other soft skills, and some make it and some don't. And some orgs give a safe enough environment where when you go back to engineering, it's not a shame or a fail. It's like, it was understood you're dipping the toe in the water and stuff. So,
right. Well, I'll give you my personal example. I started my career doing research and development in AI and machine learning at a military owned think tank in DC. And I spent a few years here, 3 years there. And my frame was like, I got to stay in AI and this is what I should do the rest of my life. And anything else is a sellout.
Yeah.
And then I tried something else. And I tried a couple other things. And then I ran a game developer and that was great. But what I'm doing now, right, I consult to product management engineering groups about how to make them more effective. Everything, I think I said this in the beginning, small companies to large companies. Like I didn't imagine that this was a thing someone could do, and I am so much happier.
It's when you're in that kind of bliss, you can't even fathom what retirement would be, because you're just bored and staring at the four walls. You know, that's a great place to be.
Yeah, doesn't mean you got to do what I do to be fun and have fun and in your career and be happy. You need to do something. Doesn't have to be this. There's other choices. Right? Different courses for different horses, but you got to find the one for you.
Okay. Well, you did a really great tie-in between growth and career pathing. That's one of the most succinct ones yet, just sort of the alignment and so forth, and really questioning, like, well, why do you think you want to be there? You know, we can probably align a lot of things for you as an individual here at a company, but, you know, the why part. Kind of mixed into that, you get scenarios where people have maybe been there for a while, even after a couple of years, 2, 3, 4 years, definitely. If there hasn't been a lot of movement out of a role, someone's going to get stuck in a rut for sure.
Yep.
So, I mean, what do you do about that?
Well, look, I'm a big believer in squads, right? Now, over time, these models might change, but the Spotify squad model is one of the better models for doing development. There's others that are good as well. But my thing about being in a squad is you're required to stay in that squad for 90 days. So yeah. you're in a particular part of the architecture of a company as a developer, and you're required to stay there in 90 days. And after 90 days, you can raise your hand and say, I've had enough of this one. I would like to go to another one. That doesn't mean you get to immediately change. It means you get on the list to, at the next natural break, to swap something else. And so in asking people to raise their hands, not telling people that they can raise their hands, but to ask people to raise their hands, they get opportunities to see other parts of the architecture, other things they can do as developer. That, so that answers part of your question, which is, how do you not get stuck in a rut? Is, as a manager, you actively say, who wants to raise their, or you recognize how long someone's been there and say, do you want to raise your hand or not? You don't have to, you may. That answers in this role in another part of the architecture. But there's other questions like, I'm a developer, I want to be an SRE. Or I'm an SRE and I want to be in QA automation, right? Or I'm in one of those and I want to move to a management role. Part of this has to be, or a large part of this has to be generated by the person. I'm bored, I want to see what else is there. And once again, being in a company that's growing makes a lot of this easier. But, it behooves a manager to ask their people. Now, there's a disincentive for a manager to do this. I've got a really good person working for me, and I'm going to ask him or her, do you want to move out of my group?
Right.
But writ large, great developers, great engineers of any type are hard to find. I'd rather have them in my company than in someone else's. And if they're going to be bored in my group, sooner or later they're going to make a change. I'd rather have them go down the hall than to the company next door. It's good to have them down the hall in your company. So, it may hurt you in the short term, but better for you in the long term if people tend to stay in. So ask your people, right? But also, once again, the primary responsibility, I had someone who worked for me and said, you're responsible for my career growth. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm here to help you because I'm trying to be a good guy, but you're responsible for your career growth. But, because I like you and because I think you're talented, I'll help you with that. So you, as a manager, you ask for someone, but as the person, you have to think about what I want next. And you have to decide, do you trust your manager to mention that? How do you find that?
Yeah, definitely. And that's been a theme. A lot of these topics, a lot of these conversations lately have gone a little bit off track into effective one-on-ones and how that goes down and stuff. And the way I've seen that work well is in one-on-ones, the best people are bringing their notes to the table. They're reading their notes for the first 2 minutes before we start. They're taking notes as we're talking, and they're capturing their own goals themselves. Where I've seen sort of a silly fail is where, as a company, we have software to track your growth or your goals or whatever. And, as software developers and engineers and stuff, we don't clock into work. We don't clock out of work anyways. So who wants to go to a bean counting program to say, I'm 27% to goal learning Rust right now or whatever.
Right, right.
That's awful, right? But
and what does that even mean?
Exactly. What does it mean? It's like people get a little crazy on measurements. It's like when it's for the individual's growth, they either come to the gym and do the reps or they don't. But the best are even have an extra layer of organization, their little black book and their notes, whatever they want to do. And just like with any other meeting, you're not leaving the room until there's outcomes and assignment of outcomes. Usually it's always on the IC, although maybe if you're enabling them to do something or you're enabling them to lateral, you as a manager need to do some internal comms as well. So there's some facilitation, but you're right, it's mostly all the individual. And the better organized they are, and the better they take notes and remind themselves of what they committed to, et cetera. And again, this is not just in team success. That's already a given, right? We want to talk about the extra stuff that keeps you even more well engaged with work.
Right. I will tell you, with my one-on-ones, all of them are a shared Google document.
Yep.
Where we're jointly typing in the document as we're meeting and making commitments and goals, but also retaining a record of what we said.
Yep.
So we can revisit it.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's a great idea. Plus you have the ability to comment and resolve right. and all kinds of things. So you know that things are checked off the list. That's a great workflow. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So I do I do coaching too, right? I coach CTOs and chief product officers. Do the same thing there.
Continue. If you want to riff on that, go for it.
No. I mean, it's just that, but it's the things that you just added to. It's like, it's a shared, I also, by the way, just for the record, like, particularly if they're on Zoom, they're recorded. I use Voicea that does a audio transcription real time with the audio, which then you can reference back to the Google document, which you're jointly typing, which you could put action items on, which you can throw out to Asana. Like all of, you know, this is all part of an infrastructure I use. You don't have to be as complicated as I am to do this, but there's tools out there that will help you, you know, track where you've been and where you're going and make commitments and see if you've done them or not.
Yeah.
And you don't have to use my set. You can use any set, but I encourage you to use a set. And I would start with Google Docs.
Yeah, totally. I mean, in this day and age, there's no excuse for anything. There's so much tech for everything. Even with my kids growing up, it's like everything that you ever wanted to know is on YouTube. And of course, they go and learn the cheats on Minecraft or whatever. But I mean, I learned to fix my mower. I learned to fix it. Like, there's every bit of knowledge you ever want. You can watch.
Oh, it's
thousands incredible. Of them. You know, it's like in this day and age, like back in the day, maybe 30, 40 years ago, you needed an encyclopedia set in your room to like do a book report on something. I mean, nowadays there's really no excuse. It just literally takes motivation. Yeah.
There's no excuse for not finding the data from the third party. There's no excuse for not running your life like the Truman Show. Right? Yeah. You don't have to broadcast it to everybody,
right?
But you could broadcast it to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Now we go to the last piece, which is my wild card round. And wild cards are something I even did a lot when I was interviewing lots of people, just to have like a fun side conversation or another related conversation to work and stuff. And in this case, the theme was bad interviews or bad candidate experiences from either side of the table, whether it's been when you were interviewing somewhere back in the day or when you're conducting interviews. So it's pretty much open book, just anything from the interviewing history you've had that makes an interesting story.
You know, bad candidate interviews for me are ones where someone shouldn't actually be applying for the job. I mean, there's one thing where I ask you a set of questions and you don't know my particular field and maybe you don't perform well on the thing that I'm asking you about in particular, but you have a raw set of skills and you have the capability of learning. And I might not hire you for that job, but I might, right? Because talent is hard to find and smart talent is really hard to find. And I certainly don't expect you to know my particular platform, but you know, I might hire you, but people who don't have, and I can think of more than one example, that don't have the basic skills of doing the job on an IC level as a developer, you don't know algorithms, you don't know architectures, you just have hacked a few things together in your career, like those go poorly. As a QA engineer, like you don't have a thesis about how to write tests, what to write tests about, what a test not to test. As a manager, you don't have a sense for organization, not personal organization, but how to build an organization and how to make an organization work, how to make an organization effective. And I particularly care about whether people are aligned to their company. And when I see people who are coming into the office and it feels like a transaction, I can make more money here than I made at my last job, so I'm going to stay here until I make money the next place. Like, I've had a couple of those. Those don't tend to go well. For places that have interviewed me, it's kind of the mirror of that. If the person that's interviewing me if their primary goal is to make a stockholder wealthy, like that tends to not go well for me. I don't feel good about it. I want to be involved with companies, even in my consulting, where we're trying to produce a product that makes a market better, it makes someone's lives better, it makes some other company better, where money is a side effect of that, and you can smell the difference when you're in the room, if it's a transaction or if the company is actually pushing for something. So I don't know if that was specific enough for you, but those are the nature of things that work well for me on either side.
No, that's good. That makes a great amount of sense. I mean, a lot of them already come up in this series where, you know, people, like you kind of alluded to it earlier, where you, somebody else on the other side of the table is coming to you with a puzzle or something they've had plenty of time to think about and you're sprung on you, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I've had a few of those. Some I've performed well on, some I've not. I generally find them to be fun, frankly. But some of them are so obscure.
Yeah.
That the I'll give you an obscure one that I like, but it's a terrible question to ask in an interview, which is a Google one. And this is one from several years ago, which is you're in a room and the other room next door has got three light bulbs with three switches and you don't know which switch goes with which light bulb. And you need to figure it out. And you only, I'm going to probably screw this up, you can only go between the rooms once. And what do you do?
Right. Yeah.
You've heard this one?
Well, yeah. And we literally, an hour ago in my last podcast interview, we discussed this. And
yeah.
I mean, once it gets out that you touch the light bulb and see which one is warm, it kind of like permeates through all of the world, you know, like all these answers become online. And another person I talked to yesterday had a recruiter leak their code sim test. So like the next coders were completing it in 20 minutes and even people within the company took 60, you know?
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's one about the leaking, like leaking that, like that's the Google one's a cute question, but it's not dispositive of who's going to be good because that is not like when someone, I did not figure that answer out. Someone told me that answer. And I was like, that's really interesting and a really cute answer, but
yeah,
I wouldn't expect something like, I don't know that tells you who's good at the technology.
Yeah, you're right. It's cute. That's the perfect word. And when you're searching for immediate epiphanies, it's not fair because think of it this way. When you come to an interview, even as confident as we can be, you're on a different footing. You're presenting yourself. You have a potential towards a fight or flight response. Your brain is activating in a way that's very different than when you solve problems. And so surely maybe it shows that what kind of problem solver you would be or whatever, but it's like, it's looking like for genius in a laboratory. And I don't think it's a fair way to look for it, you know?
Well, like it's the Edison quote, right? You know, genius is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? It's hard to do that in an interview.
100%.
So hopefully, look, people are talking to me about, you know, my helping on a professional services basis on product management engineering. And like, I've got a bunch of opportunities. So no one of them makes me nervous because if I don't have this one, there's the next one. It's fine. But that's not, people feel differently about jobs, right? Because, and it's hard. And people who don't do this interview a lot, like you talk about interviewing 100 times in 10 years, I think you said, like, you probably got pretty good at it and pretty good at not caring about a particular outcome.
Yep. Well, it's like VCs and CEOs, startup CEOs. You want to raise money when you don't need it, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's like I tell people what I do and they want one or they don't want one and it's okay. And I hope they want one, but if they don't, it's fine. Right. It puts you at a different footing when you're having the conversation. It's more of a peer footing than a typical interview where you're, you know, hoping they like you. Particularly if you don't have a gig, right? Then it's even more.
Some people have crazy horror stories. I've got too many, but if I share it with you, it'll be redundant of the other conversations I've already had. But do you have any?
I've got some typical bad ones, just like back in the day when I only worked with contingency recruiters, like some of them are good and some of them are scum. And the scummy ones who shop. But I don't think I have any unique bad stories. Just typical bad stories back in the day.
So it's just nature of the game kind of stuff.
Yeah. I don't, you know. So, you know, and there's some that I would work with again, someone I would gladly recommend, and some I'm like, I see them down the street and I'm crossing to the other
side. You go the other side, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And then I wash, then I take a shower when I get home anyway, just in case.
Wow, that bad, huh?
I mean, there are some of these guys that are just, you know, they're not, they're just trying to put paper out there and they don't care what the outcome is. And some of them are really good. And, you know, and you learn as you work with a few.
Yeah, I've seen to somebody else lately, the best ones are relationship builders, and they're taking people out to one-on-one dinners and basketball games or whatever it is. And they take a real long time to build a relationship with every person, such that, and usually it's usually that they're doing this with senior people that are hard to
play. Right, exactly.
And it's such that they get to the point where they think they're going to be in market. They become what you might call a pocket listing. They're not even listed available, like a real estate listing, but of course it's a brain, not a thing.
Yeah, right.
That we're talking about here. But when they want it in your market, they reach out to that recruiter they have the best relationship with, and then they will shop them to folks like you and me, and you never could have found them through any other channel. And that's the most valuable data that there is knowing that someone is in market or passively maybe kind of in market, and you just need a little bit of extraction energy to get them out of some other valence or orbit, rather than the type of activation energy you need starting cold, which is so difficult. And a lot of the unscrupulous recruiters are making a market out of the ether. They're trying to make a two-sided marketplace, and they often don't have one or the other things really in hand. So there's this whole
facade, or
this game that they play to make you think they've got all the people, or to make candidates think that they've got all the companies. And there's a lot of shysters out there. I mean, the big agencies, the big groups put a lot of pressure on their younger talent, and that's why they turn them over so much too. So, you know, you'll see a ton of churn at these agencies when you work with them.
That's right. That's right. You know, it's, look, I didn't pick to go into that line of work. I don't envy those people. You know, I just, you know, it's hard. Like that line of work fosters bad players more than a lot of others, maybe not more than all of them, but more than a lot of others. And so the ones who do stand out are particularly worthwhile to know.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.